because teachers are a product of the American educational system, the American educational system is about air guitar for many complicated things. We basically recapitulate this posturing as though it's actually about a real subject. So it's probably going to be easier to break this cycle in the third world. Because when you're well-fed and happy, when you're in the midst of an industrial revolution that can really produce, you might not be motivated, you might not even be aware that you're not learning anything real, right? So Kim once counted from one of the recent US Census reports on America that all of the engineers, all of the scientists, all the mathematicians, and all of the physicians in America were less than 1% of the adult population. So if you think about what those four groups actually represent and combine it with the Industrial Revolution, you kind of get America. America is kind of like a third world country with the Industrial Revolution. And it actually somewhat resembles India, which has a similar thing. India has a small percentage of very highly educated people, but it doesn't have the Industrial Revolution, except in a few specialized cases. So my aim with this talk this morning is to try and use this idea of a $100 laptop that is going to go into the third world as a way of liberating us from from the political correctness that we have in America, some of which is, I think, necessary. But when we go to the third world, we're talking about 70% of the people in the third world, in fact, 70% of the people on Earth do not have drinkable water. This is one of the biggest health problems in history, far, far larger than AIDS. Probably the largest educational problem in the world is the education of women, because it is women's interaction with children that is more important than any other single factor in making change. So these are two huge goals that we should be thinking about on a world scale, and they're so much easier to think about outside of America than dealing with the stuff inside. And I believe this is a fine thing. It's why not go and help a bunch of people around the world and do it in such a way that when the $100 laptop is sold in the United States, which by the way it will be, then this new set of ideas actually comes with it. We're not just selling blank paper, but we're selling books that has a new way of thinking about things. So now when we go and take a look at Squeak around the world, what do we find? Well, again, with a few exceptions, we generally find adults who are extremely happy that the children are happy. That is their number one thing. Look at the children using computers. Their future is assured. So if you look at what the children are not doing that much. They're basically drawing pictures, and if they learn how to do animations and Squeak, they're animating stories like the ones they see on television. Okay, and why are they doing this? The reason is that the human nervous system is born with about 300 desires that anthropologists have been able to figure out so far. And one of the biggest ones of those is the desire to explain things, learn things, deal with things in terms of stories. The story structure is built into us. It's been extensively studied, and we gravitate to it as a way of doing things. In fact, I've been using it today. It is impossible to get up in front of an audience and speak real prose. The sentences are too long. The audience can't look back to check, so I have to go into shorter terms. I have to embody it in a narrative structure that everybody understands and everything. It's very cramping. So if I'm up here, for instance, trying to explain the Constitution, I'd be in big trouble. Franklin's wonderful exit interview for the Constitution which is marvelous and all this stuff, but actually I wouldn't get around to the Constitution itself, because in story terms, it couldn't be more boring. Right? Just basically as boring as a Bach fugue is to somebody who can't read music. Just look at it on the page, and it's just a lot of notes organized somehow. So the most interesting thing is that the most interesting fact about human beings here is that we do use stories for all of these things. And in fact, we can't to remove stories, because a lot of our happiness comes, a lot of our resonance comes from being able to deal with stories. And so certainly one of the goals of school is to be able to take children into the elevated nature of stories, the elevated nature of language used in this form, be able to take theater away from people, to take Shakespeare away from people. But that being said, then we have to get this really interesting situation that if you look at the last 400 years and the rise of democratic republics and of science and being able to feed people and a whole bunch of things that have happened just in the last 400 years, the ability to go get some awful things that are trying to eat you up inside, and we're crawling with them. As a former biologist, you wouldn't know how many parasites of every different size we have crawling around our body by the billions, all of them trying to eat us. And until about 1945, we were completely helpless. The only thing we had was sanitation before that. And after 1945, we were able to kill most of them. Right? So that's with most of our lifetimes. I was born in 1940. So take all of these tremendously important things that have happened in the last 400 years. The most interesting thing is that none of them have anything to do with stories. Science is not a story. That's the whole point of it. A story is something that you judge by how apt it is, how nice it is. Give you an example. If you come home from a trip and your significant other seems happy to see you, then there's a short story that explains that. What is it? Absence makes the heart grow fonder. Yeah. That's definitely what's going on. But if you come home from a trip and your significant other is not that happy to see you, no problem. Out of sight, out of mind. So one of the revolutions in history happened when Solon was trying to reformulate Athens after the infamous Draco. Remember Draconian? Most people don't know there was a guy who, in fact, practiced and preached and became so famous that his name has come down to us. And Solon came a little bit later and decided that a better society could be made by inventing ways of doing things. But first thing he had to do was to get everybody to realize what they were taking for granted. Okay, and this is perhaps the single most impressive things that the Greeks ever did. They were, as far as anybody can tell, they were the first people that realized that many important things are completely invisible. Right? If you think about what philosophy actually is, it is about trying to deal with things that most people take for granted. That was what Socrates was all about. And science is making the invisible a little more visible. Right? So this is a very important progression. And so what Solon did was to take everything that the Greeks thought was true and post them, sometimes painting on the walls of the buildings and by things on wooden frames, and posted them all around Athens. And now there are hundreds of them. And everybody was shocked, because as they went around, they discovered that for every absence makes the heart grow fonder, there was an out of sight, out of mind. So all the proverbs cancel each other out. Now, this has never bothered any oral society. And in fact, it doesn't bother our society very much because we think mostly like an oral society. And the Greeks were the first ones to think about, you know, maybe contradiction is an important new concept. You know, if we have this thing that says this, and we have this thing that says the opposite, you know, what kind of meaning do we actually have here? And in the story world, there's no problem because you have a story over here that talks about this, and it's like going to a movie. The movie you saw last week could contradict the movie you saw this week. You could love both of them because the movie is a little world, another little world. This proverb is a world, that proverb is a world. And in our brains are set up that way. Because just imagine how difficult it would be for us to function if we were actually logical beings. Because we have to know much more about the universe than we do in order to reason about it. But by just compartmentalizing things into something like case law, right? Case law is completely contradictory, but it doesn't matter because what they do, like people dipping into the Bible, they dip into it, one side finds the precedence they like, and the other side finds the precedence they like, and never is thinking done because they don't know how to think about the law from first principles. So the only time thinking is done is when people try and reason from the Constitution, which is a set of principles that the country is supposed to be resonant with. So if you think about the strengths and weaknesses of story-like thinking, it's a disaster when you're trying to do something important. Because people can be swayed. So actually, here's a theater. So if this were Shakespeare, we could have, if I dyed my hair and applied makeup and had the lights way down, I could pretend I was a 27-year-old worrying about my old jester friend, York. And if this were done carefully, everybody would be riveted on this completely artificial setup. Couldn't be more artificial. And yet people will cry because our brains are set up to take this form of artificiality as real. That's great. We want that. Because theater is a magic mirror. What theater does is not tells us stuff, it makes us remember things. Right? So the idea of in theater, successful theater, is when you can basically act as a mirror so that you can beam the audience's intelligence back at them. So Coleridge said, people go to bad theater hoping to forget. That's television, right? It's a dope. I do it myself. I can't watch regular television, but I like sports. It's perfect. Nothing important goes on, and a couple of hours later, you feel better. But suppose we go into the exact same auditorium, and we have the exact same lighting, and the exact same music, and the exact same actors, but now it's a political rally. Right? Political rallies are staged like theater, and the attempt is to be entertaining. The attempt is to involve people in the story that the politicians never tell you something that isn't a story, and to try and get you to think that their story is apt. That's the story that resonates with you. That's not thinking. That's not even remotely thinking.